happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, that's John Rauhouse playing in the background. If I can pull back the curtain a little bit on all things Fretboard Journal, let me just tell you that I love doing this podcast. We've been doing it for what seems like about a decade. We were one of the very first guitar podcasts around. Now we've got Luthier on Luthier, which is a podcast dedicated just to deep chats about the world of luthery. I'm co-hosting an amp podcast, The Truth About Vintage Amps, which you hopefully know all about. And then we've got this podcast, which can go in pretty much any direction we want it to. I want it to on a weekly basis. And I think for the rest of the year, I'm just going to have fun with it. I am going to be interviewing folks who may not be on your radar, may not be household names, may not be well-known luthiers or maybe players, but are just cool people who I've stumbled upon. I want to keep this podcast interesting. I want to keep it different and unique. I also want to get all of you guys out there motivated to be playing instruments and trying out new instruments and seeing what is out there. So we're going to start off with Eric Coleman. Eric Coleman is one of my favorite people in the guitar industry. He works for Stuart McDonald, the juggernaut when it comes to luthery tools and working on guitars. Eric and I go way back. I think we may have met through Nico Case, musician Nico Case. Eric, Nico, and I all at one point have had pet greyhounds, and I think that might have been the common ground. But I've known Eric forever. He now has a very large following on Instagram and Facebook just as Tones Chaser. I will include a link to that in the show notes. And he is one of the great guitar repair people, but he's also still a punk rocker at heart. And so I love talking to him. I hope you enjoy hearing his story. We have, like I said, a bunch of podcast interviews I'm going to be unveiling on you for the next couple of months that are just kind of fun and unique and with some people who I've known about and I want to share their story with you. So I hope you like it. Maybe you know some folks that we should be talking to who have an interesting story. If so, you know where to find me, jason@fretboardjournal.com. Fretboard Journal 45 is off to the printer. We're going to be seeing that showing up soon, and then it goes to everybody's mailbox after it gets packaged in the protective cardboard mailer that comes from our friend at Mono Cases. And speaking of Mono, they are sponsoring this podcast once again and all sorts of other stuff that we do around here. I've been bitten. I don't know what happened to me. I think it started with this amp podcast. It's kind of the gateway drug. Now I'm looking at pedals and pedal boards. I've been looking at those Mono pedal boards over at monocreators.com. I already love the case that they provided for my Telecaster, my parts caster. It's not built by Fender. That's the Mono Vertigo case. And all their products that I've seen are so cool. And now they're doing all sorts of ridiculously cool stuff with the Tysco and Harmony guitar labels. So go to monocreators.com, see what they're up to. It is fun to see a company doing things at a high level, but also just having a blast doing it and creating cool stuff. And thank you to monocreators.com for sponsoring this podcast. Our other sponsor, since I'm on the sponsor roll, is our friends over at RetroFret. As always, they've got an insane collection of vintage instruments and amps. If you are into amps, they have both a 1950 and a 1951 Fender Deluxe for sale. That's got to be someone's birth year amp. One of those has to be. They have this crazy cool 1944 Epiphone Broadway arch top with, I don't even know how to describe it, sort of this gray burst, amber burst thing going on. Not a normal sunburst, but very distinctive and very cool looking. And it's from 1944, so you know, you get all your street cred points. They also seem to have cornered the market on Burns guitars and Burns-related guitars. And right now they have a 60s Ampeg Wild Dog, sort of this offset, crazy-looking electric guitar that was built by Burns, and a lot more. Go over to retrofret.com, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Speaking of electric guitars, we are now taking pre-orders on the Fretboard Journal's Electric Guitar Annual. This is going to mail out right before Christmas to everybody. Got in just under the wire of 2019. But we're doing it. An incredible array of stories. I'm sort of floored by both issue 45 and the electric issue. All the stories we've crammed in there. Sometimes we have like 10 stories in a Fretboard Journal issue. Sometimes we have like 20. I think we're kind of in the middle there on both these, but some incredible stories, some that are very close to my heart in the electric issue, and I can't wait to share them with you. So if you go to fretboardjournal.com and click on the shop tab, you'll see the pre-order for either the print edition, which I know we will sell out of, or the digital edition, which we definitely will not sell out of. And we still have digital editions of the first Electric Guitar Annual that we ever did back last year. That's all the news I have for you. Again, thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoy my podcast interview with Eric Coleman. He is one of my favorite people. It was great to get his backstory. Honestly, aside from the fact that he played music and worked on guitars and had Greyhounds, I didn't know a lot of this stuff, so we're learning it all around the same time. And thanks again. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you like the podcast, and share it with your friends. Here's my chat. Eric Coleman, thanks for talking to us. You're not the easiest guy to get a hold of.
It happens. I've got a lot of things going right now, so I do apologize for that for sure.
You are one of the few working luthiers I know who actually posts pictures from gigs. You're still playing.
I do. I am. That's still my favorite thing about all of this guitar stuff is the fact that I'm still dragging out the gear and playing music on a semi-regular basis live.
Yeah. Well, before we get to your life and whereabouts these days, I run into you at NAMM. We have breakfast every year. We have a gazillion mutual friends. I follow you on social media, but I don't really know your backstory. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Rochester, Minnesota, and I was there for about 5 years, and my dad took on a teaching job at Indiana University in the early 70s, so I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, and that's where I that's where I started playing, and then that's also, like, the very first shop that I ever worked in was a place called Roadworthy Guitar and Amp, with a guy named David Bass, who's a really, really awesome repairman and a player as well, player and performer. I worked with him a little bit. This would have been, you know, the early 90s, I guess. But, you know, the whole guitar thing kind of went a little bit, earlier than that, but you know, meeting him, I worked in a guitar shop, and then later on, I lived in Fort Wayne for about 10 years, and it was good location when I was, at that period of time, I was doing a lot of touring with a couple different bands, and so Fort Wayne was a good central location, and that's really where I first started establishing myself as a guitar repair guy.
Yeah. Bloomington, Indiana, that's where Breaking Away was filmed, right?
That is where Breaking Away is from.
You have lots of memories from the quarry?
All of that. I was, you know, where they shot that was, pretty much in my backyard. So I was around during the shooting of the majority of that movie.
Wow.
So, yeah, saw a whole lot of it. And, all the actors and stuff in the movie were they were hanging around, so it was a pretty fun time, actually.
Yeah. Didn't inspire you to take up the bike, though. The guitar was more your speed.
Yeah. Well, I did. I did ride a lot of bikes during that period. It was kind of definitely part of the culture in that town for sure.
Yeah.
It was definitely a part of my life for sure.
So, was this a... taking up guitar repair? Was this sort of like a necessity is the mother of invention thing? You're on the road with these bands. Things are breaking all the time.
Just out of curiosity, really. When I got my first guitar, my first electric guitar, it probably would have been 80 or 81 or something, and I got it for Christmas. It was a Hagstrom Swede.
Nice.
And I can remember the first thing I did was take the whole thing apart to see how it worked. I had the manual and stuff, and I was just curious. And so I stripped the whole thing down on my bed, and I can remember my older sister like telling me that she was going to tell my parents that I broke my new guitar and all this stuff. But I just had to know what made it work. And then I started, bothering my friends to let me see their guitars and mess with their guitars. I can remember a lot of friends had Strat style things at the time, and I would take the back cover plate off and start messing with the springs and trying to get their tremolo to work better. And I can remember at some point I heard some feedback from some other guy saying, "Hey, don't let Coleman mess with your guitar, because he'll take that back panel off and mess with those springs. And I've heard that if you mess with those springs, that it ruins the guitar." So.
A reputation.
Had a bad reputation right away. So so it started early on, and then always hung out in guitar shops. There was a place in Bloomington called Tom Pickett's Guitar Gallery, and I would skip school and go down and hang out there all day long. And there was a couple of repair guys there that were Ron Keith was an excellent local player, and another guy named Jeff Foster, and they seemed to handle most of the repairs at that place. And I was always there just poking around their benches and watching them work. And then further south down the road a little ways in Nashville, Indiana, Brown County, there was a little shop that had John Grevin had a shop there.
Oh, wow.
And John Grevin and a dude named Ron Volbrecht. And they did a bunch of really, they were primarily builders and stuff, but they also did, a lot of the heavier repairs in the area, like neck resets and Floyd Rose installs and, all kind of custom building and stuff like that. So that was the early inspiration, was the guitar gallery, and then the Grevin and Volbrecht shops.
Yeah.
And then David Bass, when he opened up Roadworthy Guitar and Amp, he actually was I got hired on as a counter guy, was constantly back watching him work. And so that was really where it started manifesting itself. And then it wasn't until I moved to Fort Wayne where I got the confidence to really start just digging in. And I did some pretty shady early repairs, because I didn't have any you can read books and all that kind of stuff and absorb what you can, but there's a lot to be said by seeing it actually done in front of you. And at that point in Fort Wayne, I couldn't find anybody that would let me do an apprenticeship or anything like that. So a lot of times I was just winging it. And so sometimes I wish I could get some of those guitars back, so I could fix them up
the right way.
Better than what I did when I was just getting started.
What now? All this time while you're hanging out at guitar stores, are you buying stuff? Are you starting to collect, or are you just the kid who's hanging out at the guitar store?
I was just the annoying kid that was hanging out in the guitar shop. I didn't. There was a few. At that point, vintage guitars were still kind of more. They were more like used guitars, and so I was buying things, but not. Even thinking about them in terms of collectability, I bought 57 Les Paul special for $200.
Damn.
And this would have been in the 80s. I bought a 68 or 69 SG Standard for $100. And then I had one that was really cool, which was a stripped gold top. It was a stripped 57 gold top. And at the time, you know, it was, I think I got it for $250 or $300. And, you know, the PAFs and all that were in it. It just had the gold stripped off of it. And so I had those kind of things, you know, playing around and stuff. No, I wasn't really hip to any cool amps at the time. They were around town, but I wasn't really into them or anything. But man, as soon as the vintage market started winding up, you know, like right around the time Guns N' Roses started getting popular, I jettisoned all those guitars, you know, once they got up around $1,000 or whatever.
Got it.
Yeah, and my dad was like, oh, don't ever sell those, you know. Like, oh, I won't. And then, of course, I totally blew them just because, sheesh, you know, I thought I'd be able to buy, you know, $100 vintage Gibsons forever.
I thought you were making out, yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't really get into amassing a bunch of gear until I moved to Athens here. So that came later. You know, the touring years and the early guitar repair years, my collection was really stripped down to just a few pieces that I still have actually today.
Yeah. What kind of music were you playing and what were the bands like?
It ran a pretty wide thing, you know. I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and so my first bands were definitely inspired by, you know, 70s and early 80s rock and, you know, kind of the early metal stuff. So there was my very first band, definitely, we played a bunch of, like, you know, Thin Lizzy and Black Sabbath, and I guess there was probably some Tom Petty songs in there, and just rock and roll in general. And then probably later in high school, I got in with a guy who was kind of like a garagey type rocker, and joined his band and, you know, did a bunch of, again, classic rock type covers and stuff. And then right around that time, I got really kind of bored with the type of music that was going on and met up with a group of guys, and we just started creating this pretty bad and, you know, offensive music. But from that point on, most of the bands that I've been playing with has just been writing original music. So since that would have been the late 80s or so.
Yeah. And your role in the bands is guitar or bass or everything?
It's always pretty much been guitar. There's been a couple projects where I played bass just for very short periods of time to fill a gap or something like that. So it's always been guitar.
Mm-hmm. And these days you have both a repair shop and a store, right?
I don't have a store.
Okay.
It looks like a store.
Okay.
But it's just my mass pile of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. I there for a while, I refused to come off anything. And over the last year, I've kind of come off of a few pieces to finance some other pieces of gear. And I kind of enjoy it. So I might actually thin the herd for real a little bit. Who knows though? But yeah, I do have a stupid amount of stuff.
And you're doing, like, walk me through, because it seems like, I know you work for StuMac, but it seems like a lot of StuMac guys, yourself included, like, have other things they do when they're not, you know, none of you guys seem to be in a cubicle typing out catalogs. You're all working. What's your day in the life like when you're not on the road playing music?
Well, my position at StuMac, is my official title there is senior technical advisor.
All right.
And what I do is I do a lot of research and development stuff, you know, help develop new tools, test new tools and products and stuff like that. So you're right. The majority of my time, even though it is, you know, I do work full time for Stuart McDonald. The majority of my time is spent in my shop. Like right now I'm currently, writing instructions for some new electric guitar kits that we're going to be selling, you know? And so, I do all the assembly instructions with a photographer and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so that's has me at the bench, you know, putting stuff together and doing things. And then, you know, I've also, like I said, testing new stuff. You know, people send us things all the time, tools or just suggestions for tools and things. And, you know, a lot of times we'll pursue these to see if they're something that we want to sell and carry in our catalog and stuff. And so, you know, those have to be tested somewhere. And a lot of times I'm right there, you know, my shop is, just a couple blocks from Stuart McDonald. And, so it's easy for me to just skip over here, or skip back over there to do a couple things if they need me to.
Yeah. And what came first, the shop or the Stumac gig in terms of you in Athens?
The Stumac gig for sure. I, was, just, I was buying a bunch of Stumac tools, and, I was, again, you know, like I had all Dan's books and stuff, and I, you know, the videos, they hadn't really ramped up their video stuff yet, but I did have Dan's videos, and, but there was, you know, I was just kind of had, I always had more questions than answers. And so, then there were available answers. And so there was a forum, and it's still happening. It's not as popular as it used to be, but there's a forum called the Les Paul Forum. And at that particular time, Dan had a his own section, you know, his own little page on there that was called Dan's Guitar Shop or something like that. And I would ask him questions, and my screen name on there was Indiana Eric, because I was still living in Indiana at the time. And one day he just asked me, you know, like, hey, if you're in Indiana, why don't you just come down here? I teach people how to do this stuff. And so I made arrangements and came down and, you know, spent, I don't know, I spent like maybe 4 or 5 days with him just initially. And me and Dan hit it off really, really well. And then came down another time or two. And then I went to the Asia Symposium, which is the East Coast, you know, guitar builders convention. Sure. Kind of thing. And I went to that and I met Jay Hostetler. And again, me and Jay got along really well. And it was probably a couple weeks after that that trip to the Asia Symposium that I came down and did an interview with Stumac and got hired. So that was 16 years ago last July.
Wow.
And it's been pretty much 100% immersion in music and luthery ever since.
And when you first went and visited Dan Erlewine, were you already basically a full-time or professional repair guy, or were you still trying to get your feet on the ground?
I was not at all a full-time repair guy. I was, I knew, a fair amount, you know, cause I had been tinkering at that point, you know, since I was a teenager. I knew a fair amount of stuff. I was doing, refrets and things like that, minor structural repairs, a little bit of finish work and stuff, but, a lot of it had to do with me and Dan was, I just like, I don't know. I kind of like cataloged ever since I was started getting into guitars. I started cataloging a lot of stupid or what I thought at the time were worthless little details and stuff. And so I have this like ridiculous base of guitar tidbits that I was able to, you know, impress Dan with enough to where me and him, you know, just start, you know, geeking out really hard and going really deep on a lot of nerd level little aspects, in particular Gibson guitars and a lot of the weird little quirky things that you see on those things over the years. You know, we had a lot of fun just on that, you know, fun friendship level. And so that made it real easy for him to invite me back to do, you know, to hang out with him again. You know,
yeah.
that doesn't always happen. Sometimes people come and visit Dan and they don't come back, you know.
When for that very first visit, did you have like one pressing question or want to see him do a neck reset? Or was there like one thing that was still kind of eluding you that you wanted to learn?
There was a few things that I wanted to learn. And there was a couple things there. One of them was I can't remember what model Gibson it was. I think it was like a J185, and I couldn't get the neck out of it. And I didn't want to really keep pumping more moisture into it or anything because I was afraid I was going to really loosen up the block. And it turned out that it had been retopped at the factory at some point in its life. And the top, you know, so the top went straight over the dovetail rather than being, you know, routed before they put the neck in. So they just peeled the top and the fingerboard, and then they put the new top on.
Wow.
And so I couldn't get, you know, and I had no idea. I'd never seen that or come across
sure.
that or anything. So I brought this guitar to him that had a neck that was like halfway off of it. And so that was really pretty quick, actually. He showed me what we ended up doing was just cutting through the fret slots between where the neck joined the body and, you know, the where he thought the end of the dovetail was, and just pulling that whole section of wood out. It came right out. So that was something. It sounds hairier than it actually was, but that was on my mind. And then there was just a couple other fretting questions. I was really at that point, I was really, really wanting to step up my fretting game, and so that was a big part of what him and I talked about when I was here that first time.
Yeah. And when you first got that job at Stumac, fast forwarding a little bit, were you kind of working at their headquarters? I mean, did they give you free rein from the get-go to kind of do your thing?
No, not at all. when I first started working there, my job was I was in a phone room technician, and so I took all the calls. It was crazy. Live calls all day long.
Oh, my God.
From
luthiers all over the world?
Yeah.
Or wannabe luthiers?
It was all people that had some kind of issue, you know. You know, you don't get sent to the tech line unless something's wrong. And so for that first couple years, it was I was pretty much just, you know, I was on the phones pretty much all day long. And then I spent my evenings and my weekends over at Dan's shop or working in my own shop. And, but mostly with Dan during that time.
Wow.
And so it wasn't until, it was kind of interesting. You know, my wife, Melissa.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know her? Have you ever met my wife?
I've met, yeah, once, I think.
Yeah. She, when her and I started dating, she was technically my supervisor, she was technically my boss, even though I had a supervisor that was in between the two of us. And that was kind of considered a conflict of interest at work. And so at that point, they moved me over to work with Jay Hostetler in research and development. And so when I started working with Jay in research and development, that's when I started getting the ability to, you know, more hands-on shop work and just participating in the, you know, the gears that make Stuart McDonald work, you know, and as far as the tool design and the products go.
And now, I mean, Stuart McDonald is booming, it seems. You guys are just on fire and all the videos and everything. What is you're actually now doing repair work. Just, you know, people can send you their guitar, right?
Yeah. I do most of the stuff I get, I take in through the mail. I like to do, here in town, there's a lot of great musicians in this town. A lot of them don't have a lot of, you know, disposable cash or anything to maintain, you know, even their instruments. And so I do a lot of local stuff for local musicians on the cheap. And I'm part of an organization that helps puts musical instruments and lessons and stuff in the hands of people in the county that couldn't otherwise afford that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of there's a really good organization here that they provide the money for lessons for a bunch of people, all ages, not just kids. And I maintain instruments for them, you know, because a lot of times these people have instruments that are not really playing very well or anything. And so if I can help them get those things tuned up enough to where they can at least learn on them, you know, I do that you know, pretty regularly, fairly regularly.
And what's the name of your shop for folks who are curious?
I do not have a name.
They just find you.
Yeah, they just find me.
All right. Yeah,
usually people will, they'll hunt me down through Stumac or something like that. But it's I'm not that hard to find.
No. And you have a huge social media presence as Tones Chaser.
Yeah, that helps too. That I do get quite a bit through there.
And what type of, you know, I mean, I look at your Instagram feed and I see, I don't know if all of those instruments are yours or if they're just passing through, but like, I see a very wide range of guitars and amplifiers. How much of that stuff is yours versus stuff getting sent to you?
I'd say that about 98% of it is my stuff.
Wow. All right. You've got a collection.
I do have a collection. I moved to Athens with a Les Paul, an SG, and two Marshall half stacks, and that was all I had. And then somehow it's turned into a monster.
is this a warehouse basically?
No. It's multiple levels in our home.
Okay.
we had to get a bigger house to hold all of it and all that stuff. That happened a few years ago, but yeah, it's crazy. I'm a little ashamed of it, to be honest with you, but it's a it's a lifestyle for sure.
Yeah. And I'm assuming, I know Dan is like probably thinking about retiring soon or semi-retiring. I don't think he'll ever give up guitars. Are you still learning stuff from him? Are you still going over there and geeking out on how all this stuff gets put together?
I don't spend as much time with Dan as I used to.
Yeah.
But he lives really close by. And so whenever there's anything super cool that he's working on, he always calls me over and we go check it out and go over it and all that kind of stuff. You know, right now he has officially retired from Stuart McDonald.
Okay.
He retired about 2 weeks ago, I think. And right now his shop is, you know, what he's got going is he's got a team of younger folks that he's just kind of passing the torch to. And so he's got a couple of the crazy things that, you know, everybody knows Dan is the guy to do. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the stuff he's doing right now are just kind of the routine things to get all these people's chops up. So he does, there's a lot of neck resets, there's a lot of refrets, nuts, saddles, cracks, all that kind of stuff. The routine things. And mostly these people are doing that work. His apprentices are doing this work. But man, he still does get some, absolute crazy basket case stuff in there. That really, he's the only guy in the world that has the thought process and the patience to pull off. And he does. Right now, he's got a couple just fantastic projects in there that I can't wait to see how they turn out when they're done.
Yeah. And talk to me a little bit. You mentioned, you're kind of reviewing tools and jigs and little hacks for Stumac and things that might be products one day. Are you also inventing stuff?
We all do. We all kind of throw things in the mix. So there's a couple things right now. I'm working on, a tool that, I developed. I put a crude version of it on my Instagram page, but, I do a lot of work on, I like to take those old K's and harmonies and stuff, the Chicago ones.
Sure.
And, soup them up and make them playable. I make them roadworthy or whatever. Better tuners, run a ground wire to the tailpiece, and just do a few things to them to make them a little more user friendly, and refrets and stuff. But one of the things I like to do is put side dots on those, because most of them don't have side dots. And so I made some goofy little fixture to where I could accurately and repeatably place side dots down the fingerboards of these things. And it's sounding like that or some similar version of it is going to end up in the Stuart McDonald catalog at some point. So there's a few things that I've definitely had my hands in, like the Z Files was another one. I did a whole lot of work on that project. And then, sometimes it might just be providing information, like the truss rod rescue kits, for instance. When we first came out with that tool, we just had the 1032 thread, thread cutting die in there. But Fender varied considerably over the years with like 1024 and 832 and 1032. And so when we decided that we wanted to add the other thread cutting dies to that tool, I went ahead and started gathering up information to try to find out what the timeline was between when Fender switched between those three different threads. It's all just nerdy stuff, chasing it down. And, those finding little details like that is some of the most fun parts of my job at Stumac for sure.
Yeah. I mean, what's your take on this little slice of our universe? You've been at this for a while. You started out answering calls from people who couldn't, put their kits together. Whether do you feel like the world of luthiers is still growing? I mean, you certainly are selling a ton of tools. Are people, just taking up guitar building like never before?
It's wild. It's hard to get a really, like, Instagram is a nice window into what is happening, I think, in the luthery world, because, like, we can do, as a business or something, we can do like surveys and stuff like that, but it doesn't really give us a good grip on who's doing what. It always seems like and I don't know if you want to edit this out. It almost seems like old white dudes are the dudes that are into luthery,
Of course.
But if you look at Instagram, man, there's freaking people of all ages doing all sorts of, you know, all everything, doing all sorts of really, really great stuff. And it runs the gamut, man. There's people that are, you know, using technology, CNC machines and stuff, to the best of their abilities, and making just some incredible guitars that have, you know, just super tight build tolerances and stuff like that. And then there's other people that are jigged up and doing, you know, this stuff by hand, you know, that is just absolutely stunning as well. So I think that the trade, as a whole is definitely moving forward, and I'd like to hope that it's growing. You know, if StuMac business is anything, it definitely, I would say that it's growing. So I do, yeah, I do think that things are moving forward for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize, and maybe I was just had blinders on, but until we did this Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, which has been going for almost a year now, like, I had no idea how many people were into not only taking apart amps and repairing them, but like your amp kits. Like, we get so many questions about those things every week.
Oh yeah. It's amazing.
So what's your, on this whole journey that we've outlined, have you built many guitars from scratch?
Not a lot. I have, you know, I have, I'm all jigged up for it. I you know, I decided on a shape and features and all that stuff years ago, and I made all the jigs and fixtures and all that kind of stuff. And I rattled off a few of them, but, not any substantial numbers or anything. And here's the thing. I have, a pretty short attention span. And so I think I loved getting everything together to make the guitars more than I actually liked making the guitars. And so that's kind of been, it's kind of been where I've been at that, you know? So it's like, I have all the stuff and I could do it again if I wanted to, but, I just rather do repairs, man. It's to me, it's more fun 'cause it's something different every time. And, you know, even if it's a refret or something is basic as that, you know, there's always a weird, you know, set of things you got to watch out for, you know, whether the fingerboard's, you know, going to chip up or whatever, or the slots are deep enough. What, you know, it's, everything's different, and it keeps you thinking more than I felt I was thinking when I was wanting to build more guitars.
Yeah, your short attention span comment makes me think the survey you guys should do is follow up on all these guys buying tools from you and see how many have actually built a guitar versus just tool acquisition.
Oh, man. And I'm sure there's a lot of that. You know, and even with the Luthery community, you know, it's like I'm addicted to tools, man. I love tools. And so it was especially bad when I was first getting started in Luthery and I didn't know what I really needed and what I was looking for or any of that kind of stuff. And I just bought tons of stuff and, because I thought maybe I might need it or whatever. And to this day, there's tools from my very first tool buy that I never, ever, you know, never used before or that I've never even had to use or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that there's probably a huge amount of luthiers that have bought stuff thinking they might need it and they never ended up needing it. And it's just sitting in their tool chest or they gave it away or something to somebody else. And I can only imagine there's got to be freaking thousands of customers that are that way too. You know, that they buy a bunch of tools thinking, oh, this will be cool. And they realize, well, I've talked to many of them. Cause a lot of times they'll turn into my clients, you know, they'll buy all the stuff to refret their guitars or whatever. And then they, figure out they're in over their head and then somehow end up finding me and asking me if I can bail them out or whatever.
You're still doing it after all these years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's interesting though, but yeah, I'm sure that, you know, all those kits we sell, like the, especially the, you know, the nice acoustic guitar kits and, you know, the F5 Mandolin kit and stuff. I'm sure there's probably plenty of those sitting under the bed that were like bought for a holiday present or something. And then, you know, they opened up the box and realized it wasn't like a snap together model and were just like, whoops.
Yeah. Well, how does this work as part of like the equivalent of America's Test Kitchen? Have you had to build one of those, every one of those kits?
I have built, the first thing I built when I got here was a banjo, which was terrifying for me because, you know, it still would be terrifying because I'm not a banjo player, but I'm not really even a fan of the banjo. So
you don't even have a high water mark or tone you're going for.
Yeah. So, that was kind of traumatic. I built a bunch of, ukuleles, and at that time we were selling something called the Campfire Mandolin, and I built a few of those for some finished testing, and then let me think, definitely a couple acoustic guitar kits because I was training a technician and we did some stuff with that, and then also, you know, sometimes you're building those, you know, you'll build out a box just so you can shoot a video with, like, you know, the binding tool or something, you know, so you're practically building a guitar just to use it as a prop or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the only thing, though, I started building an F5 kit with Don McRosty.
Okay.
And we got pretty far into it, man, but I just, at the time, man, the amount of time we were putting into that thing and how slow it was going, I just kind of put it at the in the back burner. And so I still have the body and the neck. They have never been put together yet, but I still have the body and the neck, and the plates are all carved and stuff. But I've never finished that instrument. So
there are probably a dozen guys in the exact same predicament who are so glad that even a Stumac employee is in the same boat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a... Those kits are incredible. Like the binding alone on it is like a whole nother skill set, aside from, you know, being good with woodworking tools and chisels and stuff like that and carving tools and stuff. You know, just doing the binding on that is a daunting task in itself. So crazy stuff.
Yeah. I mean, what if somebody out there wants to start working on their guitars, I mean, armed with YouTube and a willingness to try things, where do you suggest they start? Like, is there a starter kit for aspiring guitar techs on Stumac?
We have a couple shop starter kit type things, but what I always recommend is, you know, Dan Earlywine's video series is incredible. And also a lot of the Stumac, Dan Earlywine's guitar player repair guide, Dan Earlywine's How to Make Your Electric Guitar Play Great, the book that Dan and I wrote about fretting. I always recommend that people kind of get those books first and kind of look through them and see what, you know, because you don't, when you're looking at the catalog, when you're looking at the Stumac catalog, it's crazy because there's so many things in there. And a lot of things, you know, do the same job. And so one thing that's cool about the books is you can go through the books and you can see these tools, you know, various tools and use and stuff. And it kind of helps you decide what it is that you need and what you don't need. And so I always recommend starting with the books. And then just kind of start looking through them and figure out what jobs you're really wanting to dive into first and specialize in, and then start accumulating your tools and your knowledge then.
And is there one kit that, you know, obviously building a uke is probably easier than building an F5 style mandolin, but is there one kit that everyone who's finished like ends up just loving and it becomes like their instrument? Is there one kit that people you try to steer people to?
Boy, that's a good question. Man, that runs across that runs across the whole range of kits, actually. I mean, there's people that have had incredibly good luck with all of them, and people that have had horrible luck with all of them as well. So it's
all like, right. What's the number one mistake people make then? Maybe that's the better question.
The number one mistake that people make is probably has to do, and this would be with the acoustic guitar kits. It would have to do with neck alignment. It's, you know, for the first time, even with a bolt-on acoustic neck, it's you know, it's a thing to get the neck trajectory right, you know, the neck pitch as well as the side to side alignment. And so there's been, you know, usually when people run into difficulty, it's in at that stage of the build.
Got it. And what should people do to avoid that? Take their time, buy a tool.
Take their time, dry fit. Dry fit, you know, take your time, little bit off of each side, you know, and pay attention. But definitely don't glue that thing in until you're sure it's right, because once you do that, it's a whole lot more trouble to pull it and then repair it at that point. But there's been a couple times where you know, most times people will get it. They'll eventually nail it. But there has been, you know, maybe one or two times in the last, you know, 16 years that I've been there where we've just had to, you know, talk to the customer and agree that, you know, this is not working out. I don't, you know, because, you know, sometimes if, you know, we often give the customer a benefit of the doubt and you know, maybe it's something on our end. We'll send them another kit and, you know, see how that goes. And, you know, there was one guy in particular that we probably sent him three kits before we realized, like, yeah, woodworking is just not your specialty. And he agreed, you know, so it was cool. But,
well, I imagine you also get a fair number of guys who decide to start out with your kit, but then kind of freestyle midway through and bring their own wood into the equation, or some crazy fan fret madness or something.
Yes, definitely. There's always definitely some customizations that people like to do to the kits. So yeah, we've seen some doozies over the years for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't try to customize. I'm midway through my Champ amp kit, and I got cold feet when the bold print started to get bolder and say you could electrocute yourself from this point on. And then I'm like, oh, geez. Do I really need a Champ?
We were wondering how you were doing with that.
I'm gonna be calling you guys. Hopefully you won't answer the phone, but yeah, I'll be calling you. It's on the home stretch.
Matt Clouston is your contact.
I know.
Yeah, he'll get you.
I gotta swallow my pride.
Yeah, you know it's scary stuff, man. I mean, that's why you don't see my name on the tech list on the amplifiers, is because, you know, when we started getting into that range, I didn't know enough about it to be confident or comfortable telling other people how to build or fix these kind of things. And so I know just enough to like get me electrocuted. So
yeah, it's a good skill to have.
Yeah, so it's you're smart by not pushing it if you're not comfortable doing it yet.
I'll get there. Speaking of schematics, you had an amazing story about your dad. Do you want to share it?
Yeah, that was really cool. My dad is 86 years old. And he's starting to, you know, move pretty slow. He's starting to slow down and stuff. And he's got this garage that is just packed full of stuff, you know, three bay garage, and he has this old 1934 hot rod that he decided at 86 years old that he wanted to have a 350 horsepower custom engine built for it. and drivetrain and all that kind of stuff. And so that car got taken out of the garage so they can put this huge engine in, which is a whole nother wild story in itself. And so the agreement he made with his wife was that he had to clean out the garage before that car came back. Otherwise, he couldn't get this engine made for his car.
Okay.
And so a couple weeks ago, I went down there and we got a dumpster and just started going through, you know, freaking decades, you know, probably 50 years worth of his stuff. He's a retired graphic design professor.
Okay.
And so he had just a box and box, boxes and pond boxes of artwork and projects and things that span pretty much his whole life. And so him and I went through all these boxes and I came across this really cool little notebook. And when I opened it up, it had a bunch of hand-drawn schematics and a lot of which were amplifier related. You know, there was tube and solid state rectification circuits. There were phase inverters, power sections and all that kind of stuff. And I had absolutely no idea that he knew any of that stuff. It's not, you know, I've only known him as a designer and an artist and a professor. I've never known him as any kind of electronics guy. And so I brought that book into him. He was sitting at the table going through some stuff, and I brought that book into him and flipped it open, and I was just like, what is all this stuff? And I guess when he was in the Navy, he had to learn all that stuff in order to maintain all the navigational and communications gear on the boats and stuff on the ships. And so that was kind of prerequisite for a lot of Navy folks back then to have to know that stuff. So
it was
super cool. It was super cool to come across that stuff and listen to him talk about it. 'Cause he actually did remember a little bit of it and talked about learning it and all that. But it's funny. I had no idea that he knew what any of that stuff even was.
Yeah. All this time he could have been helping you solder.
No shit. Oops. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. He could have. Or at least troubleshoot it, man. You know, it's like when you have as many old tube amps as I do and you don't know how to work on them or you don't trust yourself to work on them, it gets kind of expensive hauling these over to my tech.
Yeah.
So if I knew my dad would have, or if I had any idea that he knew what some of this stuff was, I would have been bothering him since the 80s.
Yeah. He could have paid for this motor with just amp repair.
Right. Absolutely.
So going back to you and your work, what's on your bench right now? What are you working on? What are you excited to be tearing into?
Right now I have a, in the neck jig, I have a 1962 Fender Strat neck. That I am refretting for a fellow in somewhere in Nevada. And it's a really cool one. It's one of those guitars that was ordered. It was ordered. They wanted it a custom color. They wanted it to be a custom black.
Okay.
And but they didn't, Fender didn't have any black guitars in stock, so they sprayed over a sunburst body. And so where the arm, you know, where the arm, where the guy's arm, where the arm cut is on the Strat, where it's worn away, the black is worn away, and then you have some really cool sunburst finish coming through there now. So that's a fun one, and that's a pretty cool one. And then, you know, I've got on the other end of it, I have, you know, I have a few benches down there, and on the other, one of the other benches, I have a Squire J. Maskus guitar for a local guy that I'm putting in a Joe Barden Jazzmaster pickup in for him, and so it's I'll work on anything from whatever end of the spectrum. You know, I'm not too bad of a snob.
Nice.
Unless it's what I play, then I become a snob.
Yeah. And what are you playing these days with your bands?
Over the last few years, I've been running a few things. One of them is a it's just a American Vintage reissue jazz master that I have some Jason Lawler pickups in and a mastery bridge. That works real well, of course, because for the surfy stuff that we're playing. And then for my birthday earlier or this year, last January here, my wife Melissa bought me a Music Man St. Vincent signature model.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm nuts about that thing. That thing is just, it's an amazing guitar. You know, a lot of people hate it. It's like one of the most universally panned for appearance guitars that I've seen in modern years. But the craftsmanship on it and the playability and the sound are just spectacular on that. And so for like a factory guitar, I mean, it sure beats anything that I've seen come out of, like, you know, Gibson, the Gibson Custom Shop or Fender or any of that kind of stuff. They're making some really great factory guitars there. And then another one that I have is there's this dude named Justin Abernethy. And he used to work for the Premier Builders Guild. Remember that thing?
I do remember that thing, yeah.
Yeah, he used to work for the Premier Builders Guild before it started falling apart, and in particular, Gene Baker, and then Justin also used to work for you know, like National Resophonics and stuff like that. So he's been in the industry for a while, but he started building his own line of guitars. I don't know, maybe 5 years ago. I don't know if it's been that long yet. And I've just been kind of watching him on the Instagram, and then eventually I started just, you know, shooting the breeze with him a little bit, and he sent me a guitar to try out, and I've never played a better guitar ever, electric guitar ever. It is just like the playability is freaking incredible. And the fit and finish on it and all that is just, it's just perfect. And it's very lightweight, uses and oddly enough, this was the one I have was a prototype. And so he didn't really use any of you know, the fancier exotic woods for it. He just used, he torrified some basswood for the body, and then he had some maple neck, and the combination works fantastic.
And what style guitar is this?
It's the model he calls it is a all access, and so it doesn't look like any traditional guitar. It kind of has like a trippy looking '60s appearance, you know.
Cool.
I'll text you some photos of it, but it's got a weird like '60s appearance to it. But boy, it's just a spectacular guitar. It's got McNelly pickups in it, and I just can't say enough good things about it. It is just plays beautifully, sounds incredible. I think he's been doing pretty well with him here too. I noticed that Jeff Tweedy bought, I think, 2 or 3 of his guitars, and there's some other people that are picking them up. So. Hopefully he'll get some recognition as a builder, because he's super talented.
Yeah, you don't hear about the torrified basswood very often.
No.
Yeah. I didn't know you could even do. I mean, I know you could torrify whatever you want, but
yeah, it's just like, yeah, it's you know, it's not any wood combination that I would ever choose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's under an opaque finish, so you would never see it. So if, you know, if I hadn't asked, if he would have told me, oh, that's like a mahogany body or whatever, I would have believed whatever he told me. And you know, it didn't affect how that thing sounds. So it makes me wonder, though. I'd love to get my hands on one of his instruments that is made with the super fancy tone woods to see how awesome it is, because I'm sure they're spectacular.
Yeah. Do you have a wood stash yourself for guitars you may or may not ever make?
I do.
Yeah.
I definitely do. I have some, I really like mahogany and carina or limba or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I like those kind of woods. Those are my favorites. So I do have, some slabs of those. I do have some, ash too, since the ash trees seem to be going away. Every time I find a nice, like, blank or something that's nice, light ash wood or whatever, I'll pick that up too. So I do entertain the idea of doing it, building some more stuff, but that's going to be a ways away, I'm sure. I still have that Katrina. I bought a Les Paul that was destroyed in Hurricane Katrina.
Okay.
That I started to restore back in 2005.
How's that going?
It's slow.
So with your mandolin?
It's ahead of line of the mandolin.
Okay.
But the Les Paul is the neck is all back together and all that stuff, and the top is off of the body in three pieces. One piece is on the body now, and so I'm starting to glue the top back on in three different operations, rather than trying to rejoin the old top and get it on the body. I feel I'm having better luck locating it one piece at a time.
And was this a guitar that, had it not been through the hurricane, would be worth something?
Nope.
Oh, okay. All this work for...
Yeah, it's a 78 custom, so it's nothing that's... too valuable or particularly sought after or anything. It's just it seemed like a fun project, and so I made a deal with the guy to get it here and kept it.
Nice. Well, Eric, thank you so much for talking to us. I had no idea. I knew you had Greyhounds. I know we had a bunch of mutual friends, but it was great to hear your story.
Yeah, man. It's a pleasure and a privilege to talk to you about this, this stuff. And if you ever have any questions about Stumac or any specific pieces of gear, I tend to know a lot about this kind of junk. So feel free to hit me up.
Will do. And for anyone who wants to follow you, it's Tones Chaser on Facebook and Instagram, right?
You bet.
All right. Thanks, Eric.
Take care.